This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli.
Chappelle Show.
I don't think he's coming.
Oh. Let's start the show.
The comedy career of Dave Chappelle hasn't exactly been the model of conformity. His Comedy Central sketch series, Chappelle's Show, started out as a modest success, but exploded when it was released on DVD. The first season sold close to 3 million copies, an amazingly high number. Not only was it the most popular TV series on DVD ever released, beating even The Simpsons, but more people actually watched it on DVD than on television. By the end of season two, Chappelle was so hot that Comedy Central made him an offer he couldn't refuse, more than $50 million, in exchange for two more seasons' worth of TV shows and DVDs. But after filming a handful of new sketches, Chappelle reconsidered the offer and did refuse. Last April, just a month before the third season of Chappelle's Show was set to launch, he quit his own show, disappeared for a while in Africa, and returned to announce on Oprah Winfrey's show that it wasn't in his heart to come back. Comedy Central, after waiting in vain more than a year for Chappelle to return, has taken the skits he filmed before his vanishing act and cobbled them into three new installments. Called Chappelle's Show, The Lost Episodes, they're hosted by Chappelle's former co-stars, Charlie Murphy and Donnell Rawlings, and begin this Sunday. Many of the sketches are about how much money Chappelle was making as a TV comedy star. Here's a taste from Sunday's show. Chappelle is in the Caribbean getting an $8 haircut when news comes over the TV about his lucrative new contract.
So, you go on do your show again?
It's looking that way.
You must be paid. Big TV star.
Nah, man, it's cable. I do all right, but nothing to write home about.
Congratulations to Dave Chappelle! He's raking it in on the new season of the Chappelle Show, the Dave Chappelle Show. Reports say Chappelle has received $55 million.
Hey, man, like on TV, don't they?
All right, you all set.
How much I owe you, man?
$11,000.
Terry Gross spoke with Dave Chappelle in 2004 during the second and last full season of his show.
You said in one episode of your show that after someone complained to you that your show was offensive to black people, and that person, by the way, was white, you came up with this idea for a game show called I Know Black People.
Welcome to the show, I Know Black People. We take contestants who claim to know black people and put their knowledge of African-American culture to the test. The contestant who answers the most questions, of course, wins our grand prize. Let's bring them out one at a time now. Our first contestant is a professor of African-American studies and history at Fordham University, the New York City police officer, is a writer for such black television shows as The Chris Rock Show and Chappelle Show. Okay, our next contestant works in a Korean grocery store, is a DJ, and claims to have many black... How can black people rise up and overcome?
How can they rise up and overcome? Well, can they?
That is correct.
Reparations.
That is acceptable.
This is a rap lyric?
No, this is... I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a general question.
This is an actual question.
All right. There's a complex answer there.
That is correct.
Staying alive.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, stop cutting each other's throat.
That also is correct. How can black people rise up and overcome?
Get out and vote.
That is incorrect. I'm sorry.
Dave Chappelle, that's such a funny idea for a show. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the writing of the sketch, like what it was like to put this sketch together?
Originally, we were going to write the material. We were going to write it like an actual sketch. And when we sat down and started to write it, it was one of these things where it's like, this would be better if we got actual people and just quizzed them. And we just came up with questions. We just had them.
You actually got real people. You got like a white cop.
All those people were real. We had them get us a police officer, get us a Korean grocer, get us a black dude.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, it was completely authentic. And then all the hosting elements were just like, as far as those were like off the cuff, you know. But the answers were incredible, man. The things that these people were saying. One of the things, they're going to see me, so they kind of go for being funny, but all of them were really nervous, and they were all kind of afraid that I was making fun of them. And then once we got to shooting, I think everyone just kind of relaxed and kind of unwound. And I don't know, that's one of my favorite sketches we've done.
Now, you're really funny at doing white people. And I think, like, when you're white, you don't think of there being, like, a white accent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But when I hear you do it, I realize, okay, there's definitely, like, a white accent. So what do you do when you do white?
I take the rhythm out of my voice. I try to keep it monotone and even. But again, all right, see, I do these things. But I'm not really, it's almost like sometimes I'll watch old movies and how they portray black people, you know, with like Stephen Fetchett and all these things. I remember watching them and something in the movie made me laugh and they were like, why are you laughing at that? And it's not that I'm laughing at black people as much as I'm laughing at the way black people were perceived. Like, this is what they actually thought about black people, which just seems ridiculous to me.
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, when I do that, I think, again, it's not malicious. And it's not necessarily what I think of life. It was just a funny caricature of what, you know, what the world looks like through my eyes.
Is there a particular person you conjure up when you do a white man?
Not a particular. It's a composite. It's a composite character.
Of who?
It's funny, man. All right. You know, when I was growing up in D.C., in particular, this isn't true for me personally, but there's a lot of black people that I know who really had never had any personal experience with white people, mm-hmm. which is weird to think about in this day and time. But D.C. is a predominantly black city, and because of the economic situation and whatever, they just didn't have any contact with white people outside of being authority figures. Officer, Your Honor, you know, if it's a teacher or a principal, but it's always some kind of authority figure. So there's this whole, you know, their experience with across the color line normally happened via television or, you know, or something where you're dealing with an authority figure. So I, on the other hand, you know, my parents were split up. My mom was living in D.C. My dad was living in Ohio. I traveled to both places, so I was in the nation's capital on one end. I was in the heartland of America on another. So, I just, culturally, I kind of absorbed a lot. I don't know, man. I got a pretty good understanding about the culture. I think that all these differences are just cultural things.
Now, you grew up in different neighborhoods because, I guess this was because of your parents' divorce. If I understand correctly, you grew up in Silver Springs, Maryland, Yellow Springs, Ohio, because your father was teaching at Antioch College, which is located there, and Washington, D.C. So you went to schools in these different places, too?
Yeah, I did elementary school in Silver Springs, middle school in Ohio, and high school in Washington.
Were you almost part of, like, different cultures in those different places? Were there different ways of, like, dressing and different music that your friends listened to, depending on which place it was, whether it was the suburbs or the city or Ohio or Washington?
I think elementary school was more integrated because, you know, people were younger. They mixed freely with black kids, white kids. Everybody was, you know, there was no real racial hang-ups in elementary school. And people weren't really clothes conscious because we were young. And then by the time I got to middle school in Ohio, that's when you start seeing alligators on people's sweater and people start getting into, like, status symbols and stuff. And that was the first time where I really started, like, hey, man, I'm poor. And, like, we don't have any money, do we? And then when I got to high school, so then I started getting into clothes. Then I go to high school. And, you know, I was gone during middle school. Crack came out while I was gone. So I saw, like, the before and after picture. I had to piece the crack epidemic together. Like, I remember my first day of high school, and they were like, all right, look, if you have a pager on in school, then there's immediate grounds for suspension, because we all know what that means. I was in the back like, I don't know what that means. And then, of course, I figured out that. And then I was also trying to figure out how everyone had all this, like, gold and expensive stuff. And then I was like, oh, okay, everybody's selling drugs. You know, the crack epidemic was crazy, man. And I think a lot of the stuff that I did in my act, just coming from Ohio and then going straight back to D.C. during the crack epidemic, I think that all the inequities were just underlined.
So how did you change as you changed environments?
It's funny, man. When I was in Ohio, I was the first, like, real confident period of my life. Like, I started gaining confidence, because for these kids I was this outsider, and I had to make friends. And that was when I got, like, this huge reputation. Everyone was like, this guy's really funny. I remember in middle school everyone was just like, this guy Dave is so hilarious. Then when I got to high school and the crack epidemic was out, you know what it took to be popular during that, I just wasn't willing to do.
Which was what?
Yeah. Sell drugs.
Like, right.
If you didn't have money, you couldn't get the girl you wanted. You know, it was a crack epidemic. Selling drugs was like a legitimate job in the high school I was going to. And all around D.C., it was like girls like drug dealers because they had money. I wasn't willing to be that. But it was kind of like that context kind of isolated me initially. And then when I started doing stand-up, it was like I thrived all over again.
So when you started doing stand-up and you were still in high
14.
School? 14. Okay, in Washington. What were the jokes about? What was the humor about?
Man, the first act, Jesse Jackson was running for president, so I used to do jokes about that.
Like what?
I used to talk about stuff I saw on TV, like Alf. But they all had race in them. One way or another. Obviously, Jesse Jackson jokes don't have some racial in it. Alf, my whole thing was like the alien comes 3 billion miles from space and gets a home with the white family. That was the paradox in that joke. Which all sounds corny now, but remember, I was 14, so it was like, well, you know.
So who were your audiences then?
All right, in those days in Washington, well, again, remember, this is a majority black city. There was no black comedy club. And I remember club owners saying things like, we'll never put more than one black person on a show because it offends the audience. I've heard all these things in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was pretty exclusive. There was one point where they actually had a rule that there was no more cursing on our stage, which is like, this is in 88. And one of the comics who was black, this is pretty funny, he's like, look, man, he said, I curse. He said, black people use profanity because we live a profane lifestyle. And then he said something that I can't say on the radio. So he's basically like, if you see a roach crawling up the wall, you're not going to be like, golly gee, look at the roaches. You're going to be like, look at this roach. You know, you're just gonna go for it. I know you're going to cut that out, but it was really funny, though. But just the fact, thinking back on it, the fact that there was all these limitations and all these weird issues that these club owners had, in one way, maybe prepared me for television.
I want to ask you another question about having grown up in three different places, suburban Maryland, suburban Ohio, and Washington, D.C.
Rural Ohio.
Rural
suburban
Ohio.
Suburban Maryland, rural Ohio, and Washington.
Okay, so that exposes you to different people, different cultures, different kind of geographic landscapes, different ways of living. And I'm wondering if that helped give you the ability to kind of stand back and look at people and see what was kind of funny and ridiculous and absurd about all of us. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like you have that gift of just like looking back and standing outside and looking at everyone and seeing some pretty funny things about us all.
Yeah, because most of the people that are stereotyped, I know the people that the stereotypes are based off of. Like, personally, I've met people like this. I can remember friends of mine growing up, like, we used to all play football after school and be like, it's four of us was black. Two of us was Vietnamese. It was a Jewish guy from the Deep South. It was an eclectic group, you know, but we all got along. We all, you know, were friends. In the household I grew up in, my parents were somewhat, I don't know how to explain it, but over our mantelpiece, there was pictures of Malcolm X. You know, I listened to Dick Gregory records growing up. I listened to The Last Poets. I mean, you know, there were books all over the house and always reading stuff. So people like Frederick Douglass, I these guys' pictures were on my walls when I was growing up.
You described your family growing up as the broke Huxtables.
Yeah, we were like broke Huxtables.
Your mother was or is a Unitarian minister?
She was, yeah. I believe she was the first black woman ordained in that Unitarian church.
And your father was a music professor.
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Voice. He used to sing opera and stuff.
So your family was really very educated and probably instilled those values in you. Was there pressure on you to do well in school and what you really wanted was to be a comic?
I mean, first of all, I was a horrible student. My parents, you know, my dad was very philosophical about these kind of things. As a matter of fact, I'm the first person in my family not to go to college, like since slavery. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, didn't like that at all. She, at first, because I was 17, I'm like, I'm not going to college. I'm going to move to New York and try to make it and stand up. And she kind of flipped out. She was like, it's a dream of mine. This is a heavy guilt trip. She goes, it's a dream of mine to see all of my grandbabies graduate from college before I die. It's like, why you got to bring Diane up, Nana? That's a lot of pressure. But then my dad's whole take on it was, unless you want to do something that requires you go to college, then college could very well be a waste of your time.
And he was a college professor, so coming from him, that must have really registered on you.
He was an educator. He was an educated man. And I think my parents ultimately wanted me to be happy. You know, I mean, my argument was, you know, Dad, if you're making a teacher's salary, if I can make a teacher's salary doing stand-up, to me, I'd rather do that than teach. It's like, and he understood where I was coming from. Like, you know, it's like I didn't necessarily have to be rich and famous. Obviously, I wanted to. But that wasn't necessarily my aim. I just really, 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 to this day, I really like doing stand-up.
Since you started when you were so young, your mother did she have to or did she just want to come to the clubs with you? Was that required as like an official chaperone because you were underage?
Originally, she had to. Once everyone started knowing me, this was kind of like our routine. We'd meet down at the club. I'd be coming from school. She'd be coming from work. It was cool, man. It was like a good way to spend time together. And then at a certain age, like maybe a year into it, you know, she'd get tired at night. We'd both burn the candle both ends, but I'd always want to go, so she just let me go. And you know, not until I'm an adult, then she tells me how scary that was for her.
In what way?
You know? I mean, she tells stories like she'd hear gunshots in the middle of the night. And, you know, she went, oh, my God, it's my baby. All right. I mean, remember, this is D.C. during the crack epidemic. But I guess in her mind, it's like of all the bad things that my child could be doing, he just wants to tell jokes at these clubs. And it was a controlled environment for me. It's not like the bartender's going to give me drinks. I'm 14. It's, you know, everyone kind of looked out for me. It wasn't like I saw stuff going on, but not really. It was really goal-oriented, the time I was spending there.
Well, Dave Chappelle, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
All right. No problem. It was good to meet you.
Dave Chappelle speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. Skits he filmed before leaving Comedy Central are being showcased in a new miniseries, Chappelle's Show, The Lost Episodes, beginning this Sunday.